Thank you all for staying up, for joining me. I have the great bliss to be the dean of the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. And when they asked me to do this program, I said there are two caveats. One, I'm an old person and I can't stay up too late. And two, I am by training a psychologist, not rabbinic, not a Jewish studies expert. And I said, but I had some ideas that I wanted to share. And they said, fine, go right ahead. So I'm going to talk with you tonight about thought, about our thinking, and both from a psychological perspective and from a Torah thought perspective. I'm going to share my screen because I have material on slides that I want to share with you. So, and if possible, I'm going to even show you a little piece of a video. So let me just, put your thumbs up if you're seeing my slides. Hopefully you are seeing them on the screen now. Yes, great. And I can still get messages from you in the chat. So if you have questions or comments throughout, please feel free. What I want to do tonight is to talk about cognition and metacognition from both the psychological and the Jewish perspective. And there are really three questions I want us to address. The first is, are thoughts important? Why do they matter? And what role can and should they play in our lives? The second is, okay, let's assume that they do play a role. How do we harness the power of our thinking? And finally, as we sit here the night before Shavuot, why is it relevant right now at this time to consider our thought processes as we approach Matan Torah? So I'm going to start with my comfort zone, with the psychological view. As much as we know about how we think, I love this quote from 1999 in the journal Nature, perhaps the deepest mysteries facing, I have to move my thing out of the way or I can't see it, facing the natural sciences concern the higher functions of the central nervous system. Understanding how the brain gives rise to mental experiences looms is one of the central challenges for science in the new millennium. And we certainly, since 1999, have learned some, but there's much that is still a mystery about how our brain works and how our thinking works. There really are two separate ways of thinking about what happens in our brain in terms of thought processes. One is our cognition, or our voluntary and automatic thought processes. Cognition refers to any kind of a thought we have, whether it's adding 2 plus 2 or whether it's, boy, I can't wait to eat that cheesecake. Metacognition is thinking about our thinking. It's saying, as many of us have been saying, boy, with this working at home and all this time on Zoom, I have a little bit of a fuzzy brain. Or it's saying, I'm better at problem solving if I follow these three steps. It's our thinking about how we do things. What are the strategies that we use to get through the day, to get through mental tasks? The concept of metacognition was first introduced by a well-known psychologist, John Flavel. He discusses that it is not only the knowledge we have of our own cognitive processes, saying I've got, Zoom brain today, but it's also our ability to control our thinking processes through various strategies, such as organizing, monitoring, and adapting. When I, for example, create an acronym to remember something, that's a metacognitive strategy. I am forcing my thinking into a particular way so that I can manage a task. It's also the ability to reflect on what I'm doing. And it turns out that metacognition is an essential component of successful learning. We are much better learners when we not only know something, but we know how we came to know it. Okay, I lost my cursor here. Daniel Kahneman, along with Amos Tversky, Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Amos Tversky would have won it, except that he passed away, and they will not award it posthumously, but they worked together. And in his phenomenal book on thinking, I think I have it on my desk. Yes, Thinking Fast and Slow. I have it right here. Thinking Fast and Slow, Kahneman. He elucidates much of the research that Kahneman and Tversky did to understand our cognitive processes. And they talk about the fact that we really have two very different systems of thought. We have system one in the orange box here. That system operates quickly with little or no effort, no sense of voluntary control. It's just what happens. It's what is working when we turn to face a sound we hear, when we complete a common phrase like bread and butter, when we read words on a large billboard, when we recognize and use stereotypes. That's system one. System two is when we very deliberately allocate attention to something that takes work. And we experience it as I'm focusing on this. I'm choosing to put my attention in this place. And examples of system two working is when I come into a crowded room and I want to listen for the voice of my spouse exclusively, or when I monitor my own behavior in a social situation, or when I compare two products for which one is a better value. All of those are examples of system two. Let's look at this example of how our brain's two systems work. This is a classic study done by Kahneman and Tversky. They asked thousands of people this question. If you have this description of Steve, he's very shy and withdrawn. He's invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or the world of reality. A meek and a tidy soul. He has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. Feel free in the chat room to type your answer. Is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer? What do you think Steve's occupation is? Type your answer. Most of you, if you are like the people in the Kahneman studies, most of you said Steve's more likely to be a librarian. But in reality, that is not statistically or factually correct. There are many more farmers than there are librarians. And so if it's a question of what he's more likely to be, there's a much larger chance that even a shy, withdrawn, passion for detail, ordered and structured person would happen to be a farmer than a librarian. So how do we go wrong? Well, this was exactly the essence of Kahneman's research. He said that our brain often is hijacked by system one, by those automatic snap judgments we make that are the stuff of stereotypes, and we fly in the face of facts and statistics. What's interesting is that Kahneman and Tversky were statisticians and economists. They were mathematicians. They often knew that it didn't make any logical sense for them to choose an answer, but their brain, operating with system A, was giving them false information, was leading them down the wrong path. Now, we have endless amounts of research that tell us that thoughts matter, both for better or for worse. There's extensive research on the impact on our health of what we think. We actually heal better, have better immune systems. I always tell the story that when I was in graduate school, one of my colleagues in clinical psych left the program to go study the relationship between cancer and stress. Now, I'll date myself here because I was so old that at the time we understood very little about that relationship. And I thought, that's kind of crazy. How could stress really impact cancer? But we now know that there is a direct relationship between whether we carry healing and healthful thoughts in our head and what happens in our body, or whether we carry stress-inducing thoughts in our head. and what happens in our body. We also have an area of research called priming. If I, for example, show you a list of words that say things like aging, walker, wheelchair, arthritis, and I then time how long it takes you to walk down a hallway, you will walk slower than a group of people that saw either neutral words, flower, kite, tree, table, and slower than a group of people that saw primed words for speed, athlete, race, pace, quick. Just the act of reading words, which puts the thought in our head when we read arthritis, walker, cane, wheelchair, just the thought of aging makes us walk like older people. Thought controls or influences, impacts behavior. And hopefully this will work. I want to share with you a very clear video example of how thinking impacts behavior. I'm going to fast forward this. This is a college class.
Just do them one at a time, and I will tell you when to do them. Everybody turn it over. Just do your own work. And this isn't meant to be hard. These are anagrams. Just do the first one only. Go ahead and solve it. An anagram is rearrange the letters to form a word. Just one. Just rearrange those letters to form a word. When you're done, I need to see your hand raised. Keep going. We'll wait. Keep your hands up, please. Just do number one. Don't go on. Don't go on. This isn't meant to be difficult. Okay, put your hands down. Let's just go to number two. Don't even worry about number one. Go to number two. Solve that one. Again, when you're done, I want to see your hands up.
Oh, you hear, but you don't see it?
Everybody's hands
okay. So I understand you hear it, but you don't see it. So I'm going to go back to sharing my. I'll tell you what you would have seen. And okay. Let's see if I can do this. It was shared from within the PowerPoint, so that's not working. We'll try it this way. Now do you see it?
We're going to go ahead and do number three. For number three, rearrange the letters, and as soon as you do, go ahead and put your hand up. Here's what you need to know. You were both given two different lists. This side of the room was given these three words. And left side of the room, here you go. They were given bat. What would the word be? The second one, they were given lemon. Brian, the word? Melon. They were easy. The trick here was both of you were given the third word, which was the same. The third word was cinerama, which was American. Your first two words on this side of my classroom were not solvable. They were impossible tasks. I'm sorry. I know, but here's what we did this for. I was able to induce something called learned helplessness in the left side of the room very easily within about 5 minutes. I want you to think about what happened to you, this left side of the room, when you saw the right side of the room raising their hands because they already had the task done. What happened to you during that time? Jory?
I felt stupid.
You felt stupid?
Yeah.
Okay.
I felt rushed.
Felt rushed? Joelle?
I was even more confused.
You were even more confused because they all got it and you were still struggling. Chelsea?
Frustrated.
What happened by the time you got to the third word? Because I'm here to tell you, this side of the room is not significantly more intelligent than this side of the room. That was a random assignment. So what happened to show the differences? Why did you have more of a difficult time with the third word, which was the exact same word? Brian?
My confidence was shot.
So there's a great quick example of how one's thinking impacts the way that you're going to behave. Because not only do these students have no confidence, but as we'll see in a moment, they also stop performing. When we don't have confidence, we give up. We just say, that's it. I'm not going to do it anymore. Okay, I have to find my screen again to go back to my PowerPoint. Okay, here we are. Oops. Screen sharing has failed to start. Please try again later. Okay, that's the first time that's happened to me, but we'll give it a minute and we will try sharing the screen again in a minute. In addition to the learned helplessness, what we see in that process is the power of the self-fulfilling prophecy. And at the same time, that's a hint of something we're going to come back to again a little bit later tonight. And that's that the relationship between thinking and how we behave is a bidirectional one. Think about this cycle, this example. I have the thought in my head, I think I can do this, whether it's a math problem, whether it's learning a blot of Gemara, I think I can do this. What behavior is likely to follow? Well, then I'm going to approach the task with some effort because I think I can do it. So I'm going to apply myself. As a result, as I approach the task with vim and vigor and effort, the thought that results is, you know what? I'm making some headway. I'm not bad at this, which leads to a behavior of I'm going to keep at it and I'm going to keep trying, which further brings me back to I'm a competent person. I can do this. In learned helplessness, we saw the exact opposite of that cycle. Let me try again and see if it will let me share my screen. Oh, success. So here's that cycle that I just described in picture form. So to summarize this psychological understanding of thinking and metacognition, we come to the conclusion that thoughts and behavior have a reciprocal or a bidirectional influence. Each influences the other. And so thoughts matter because they influence our behavior. We're going to act differently based on the idea we have in our head. And metacognition provides us with some window into how our thinking works. And it may give us some tools that we'll get to later that harness the power of our thinking. So let's turn now to how does this dovetail with the Jewish view? And I have to say that as I began looking at some of the Meforshim and some of the Jewish writings on how the role of thinking and the role it plays in our life and particularly in our Torah lives, I realized that this is way beyond the scope of this year, way beyond the scope of my learning capacity, that really there is an area here to be extremely mined and studied much further. But let's start with just the very basic of how do you say thought in Hebrew? Words define the way that we understand things. So in Hebrew, we have the word machshava for thought, but we also are going to see as we look at the sources, considerable discussion of kavanah. What does the word, what's the origin of the Hebrew kavanah? It comes from kivun. It literally means how you direct yourself. Where do you put your focus? As I'm saying this, it should be reminiscent of that system too. The part of our thinking, our brain, that directs our concentration and our focus. Other words that are used include hir horim, which often is translated as reflections or meditations. considerations, thinking about something. And then in the Israel Bible Weekly, there was an article in 2018 that talked about the fact that the most common Hebrew word that is translated in biblical Hebrew as think is actually amar. And this also, I think, could be a shir in itself, the intermingling, the understanding of the relationship between thought and language. Actually, as I was thinking about our understanding of cognition from a psychological point of view in preparing for this tonight, I thought about, you know, is thought something that is unique to man? Is this something that only the human brain is capable of? I think anyone who's ever had a pet dog, and maybe even more so a pet cat, you know, knows that they're thinking something. They just won't tell us, and they don't have the language. And anyone who has experienced time with an infant or a toddler who's pre-lingual, who doesn't yet speak, knows that the fact that they don't have language doesn't mean that they're not thinking. It just means they can't communicate their thoughts and share them with us. So the fact that in biblical Hebrew, spoken words are thought of in the same way as thoughts is not so unusual. When we think about what are the parallels between the way Torah thought and the way psychological thought approaches cognition and thinking, we have to first recognize that you are not going to find in Torah and in many thought, in many Jewish writings, a direct statement of this is how we understand how our brains work and how our thoughts work. So we have to infer from Jewish texts what the writer, what the Perush is trying to tell us about thought. And we see that there are a huge number of writings on the centrality of kavana, on how important it is in Jewish life, in Torah living, to achieve this kind of focus, which goes back again to that system two that we talked about. But there are also a great deal of writings that address how do we deal with wayward thinking, with those erroneous thoughts or those unwanted, undecided thoughts that interfere, that come into our head? That is the system one that we talked about. And when we talked in psychology about this bidirectional relationship between thought and behavior, we only have to look to some of the writings on Musar and halachic precepts, and we will see those ideas paralleled as well. In terms of the centrality of Kavanah, again, there are so many sources here. It could be a shir in itself. The basic discussions of Kavanah deal with both tefillah and with mitzvot. Does a mitzvah count if I do it without kavana, without the intent? Why does it matter what I think? Isn't the chiyuv, isn't the tzivoy, the commandment to do something? We have very few commandments. In fact, I believe in the Aseret Hadibrot, there are only three that relate to you have to believe something or feel something. Others are specific observable behaviors that we have to exhibit. The Rambam talks about the fact that if we do it long enough, you know, mitok shelo lishma balishma, if we perform a mitzvah habitually, even without kavana or intent, that eventually the feeling or the thought or the kavana will come. And so therefore, do the mitzvah even if you don't have the kavana. And the Shulchan Aruch in multiple places notes the differences amongst authorities about whether intention is required or is not required, whether it's for mitzvot aseh and mitzvot lo aseh. But the bottom line is that the Shulchan Aruch asserts that these views that perhaps kavanah is not required are erroneous, and that in fact you have to have proper intention in order for the mitzvah to be considered completed. in terms of the relationship to prayer, Rav Bachya in the 11th century talked about prayer without kavana is like a body without a soul. Prayer, if we don't have kavana, is totally worthless. S.H. Parker, who is calls himself a biblical historiographer, who collects various historical findings and facts as they relate to Tanakh, his website, talks about how we erroneously, many people erroneously believe that Judaism is behavior-based, not kavana or belief-based. And he goes on to say that nothing could be further from the truth, understanding belief as a reference to internal psychological states. While the mitzvot appear to speak only about actions, the statements of mitzvot are about observable behaviors. The Torah, unlike other Near East law codes, the Torah does state higher principles. He goes on to compare it to the Hammurabi code, but he says, look at the last sentence here, Torah is concerned almost exclusively with our motives, our psyches, our internal mental states, our character. In other words, it is not sufficient to do only the mitzvot, to just do mitzvot. There has to be a mental change and a mental focus that happens with it. In terms of the second piece of how do we deal with these system one intrusions, with these the way that our brain works, that we really want to dive in, but the shopping list is in our head. Really, I'm thinking about those blintzes, which I didn't get to make today. I'm thinking about my to-do list while I'm davening my Maariv. So in the Sefer Baal Shem Tov al HaTorah, the number of references dealing with extraneous thoughts are exceeded only by those on prayer itself. In other words, the Baal Shem Tov says, this is critical. It's absolutely critical that we get a handle on these wayward thoughts. And the Rambam, in his classic Mishneh Torah, writing about Kavanah, defines it as among the five essential elements of proper prayer, along with bodily cleanliness and having a clean space. He also says that if you're distracted or confused, you have to first regain your composure before you continue or begin your tefillot. Even if you come back, you're tired from travel, you can't start davening until your mind is calm. Kavanah requires both freedom from extraneous thoughts, the Rambam discusses, and understanding that we are standing in the presence of the divine. And quite frankly, if we're standing in the presence of the divine, why are we thinking blintzes and shopping lists? The Baal Shem Tov teaches that it is so important to be present. There's a play on the word present here. That wherever a person's thoughts are, that's where he is. And in the laws of Erev Tchumim, the Tchum is established not based on where you stand, but based on where you are mentally, where you have in mind. That is such a powerful statement of how Judaism sees the critical importance of what you're thinking as well as your physical state and what you're doing. And when it comes to the third characteristic of thought that we talked about from the psychological perspective, this bi-directional influence, it is very, very clear that Heschel talks about in his God in Search of Man, performing a mitzvah without kavanah is not enough, because while it might impact the world, it doesn't impact the mitzvah doer. And the purpose of Jewish practice is transformation of the doer, transformation of the one who's doing the mitzvah and of their nefesh, their neshama. And it can't happen if we do it without kavana. Thought and action are wedded. The Lubavitcher Rebbe writes about this extensively. This is in one of an excerpt from one of his letters. He says, there are two components to a mitzvah, the deed and the intent and feeling that accompany it. It's true that the deed is primary, but the intent and feeling are of great importance. And he describes what happens when you're in a situation where it's impossible to actually carry out the mitzvah, despite your best intention and trying. That what it causes is a deep spiritual pain that pervades you to the core of your soul and that actually brings you to a deeper connection with Hashem, with Torah, and with mitzvot, which you never would have experienced without having this experience of mitzvah, of not being able to do the mitzvah, of being behaviorally blocked, but having all the intentions. In terms of the inner intent and the feeling of the mitzvah, the person in this situation achieves a height otherwise unattainable. A further of Schneerson's Lubavitcher Rebbe example is brought in another letter from the Igros Kodesh. He says, in this case, even though he's describing the situation of someone who's ill and has not yet recovered, he says, in this case, even though it seems you have to wait to express visible joy until your health improves, there's room to say, as is learned from the above-mentioned expression, I'm sorry, I had to edit, that you can be joyous before the improvement of your health, even though at the moment, this health isn't a reality. The joy itself will bring the improvement sooner. This approach follows the saying taught a number of times by Chabad Rebbes, think good and it will be good. Obviously, when positive thinking is brought into joyful speech or joyful conduct, and especially when this concerns such a respectable person whose pen is the pen of a writer, the ill person was a writer and could influence many people beyond yourself, then the reward is known. Again, the interrelationship and the way that thoughts involve and bring outcomes. How do we harness the power of thought? What Jewish advice do we have? We have the notion in Jewish practice that before we do any important activity, we say, Hineni Mulchanu Mezuman. I'm about to engage in something. That literally is saying, okay, system one that's going to distract me, go away. I'm putting my focus here. It's a declaration. I'm going to put my mind in one place. We can say out loud, now I'm going to study. I'm now going to show kibud av ve'em. I'm going to do it. We also have the understanding that it's not a good idea to run into the synagogue last minute, huffing and puffing. Halvai, we should all be able to go to shul again. But to run to minyan and arrive there, or to run to the Beit Midrash, or to run to the shiur and arrive at the last minute, we're told that it's preferential to arrive early, to center oneself, to prepare so that we are ready to be focused. And now, even as we live in these very strange times, so many rebbeim have advised, and I've taken it very much to heart. I have my little makom kavua. I have my sacred space that is now my davening place in my house. In a way, I've seen families, Erev Shabbat, that set up in their living room. Here's the Ezrat Nashim. Here is where the men are davening. This is our shul. This is the family shul. That primes us. That sets a cue that says, this is my space for davening, even though I can't be in the shul in the Beit Midrash. Psychologically, we also have strategies that have been discovered and uncovered and studied to harness the power of our thought. We can first and foremost identify our own habitual negative thoughts, habits, and patterns. And I'll give you some examples in a moment. Because if we don't know we're doing it, if we don't recognize that I have the habit of being pessimistic, or I have the habit of catastrophizing, then I can't change it. But we also can increase our focus with tools like mindfulness and meditation. We also can increase our focus in a very particular way with an exercise called a gratitude journal. The research says that if every night I write down, you have to write it, I write down three things that I'm thankful for that happened today, my mood will change, my behavior will change, I will be more resilient, stronger, and healthier. Try it. It makes a huge difference. In the same way, we can harness our thinking by making meaning, by saying, asking ourselves, what is my role in this situation? How do I understand what's happening? How do I make this into a meaningful experience? Yes, COVID-19 is terrible, but you know what? I'm going to use this time to reach out to an old friend. And I'm going to think about this as time to rekindle some friendships. There's also a technique of thought exchange. If we have time, I can review it. That says, I've got these negative thought patterns. How do I create some new ways of thinking? I want to skip to, I'll get back to why this is relevant now. Some common negative thinking or distortions. There's black-white thinking. There's forever thinking. There's blaming. And I've given you examples of what each one, how it's defined. There is, dark glass thinking, thinking only about the negative aspects, personalizing, binocular vision. These are just some of the most common cognitive distortions or troublesome cognitive habits. And some of us have very clear habits. There are, I always tell the story that I was raised by amazing, amazing parents. My mother, Admeyeva Esrim, should live and be well. And she's actually changed substantially. But when we were growing up, I realized that we were very different because my mom is a dark glasses person and I'm a rose-colored glass person. We went together to the ice cream store and there was a family having ice cream in the store that had clearly a genetic inherited deformity because everyone in the family had the same deformed hands. And my mother was, she was quacking, it's so terrible that people should have to live like this. It's horrible. It's breaking my heart. And I looked at that scene and I said, how wonderful that even people with such a handicap and such a challenge are out together enjoying my favorite thing in the world, chocolate ice cream. This is fantastic. So knowing that you have a habitual way of seeing the world can help you self-correct and learn ways to correct. I just want to come back to our, why is this relevant now? The last question, and then I'll actually, I think, have a few minutes of time for maybe your questions and comments. Why is this relevant now? Because we're about to stand at the foot of Har Sinai and to have the Luchot presented to us. And this requires full acceptance, not with system one only, not with system two only, not just, well, we'll think about it, but we won't do it. Not just we'll do it, but we don't really want to do it with thought. We stand at Matan Torah, at the Zman Matan Torah. We have to do it fully, with this fully integrated sense of both thought and deed. What's required of us as Torah Jews, and I have to say this as the dean of the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education, we think about this all the time in the field of Jewish education. What does Jewish learning need to be successful? Is it enough if we teach students what to do if we don't teach them how to think? Will behavior be enough? Will ideas be enough? It should be clear to you by now that I believe that we need both. And I'll close with the wonderful words of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks to inspire us. Judaism's genius was to take high ideals and translate them into life by simple daily deeds. The way of mitzvot, acting in accordance with God's will. We, the Jewish people, we do not just contemplate truth. We live it. Thoughts, questions, comments, I'm 2 minutes ahead of time. Wow. I see that there were many of you who, yes, Zoom is testing my ability to overcome learning chances. I will be happy if people want to email me at azrieli@yu.edu. If you want a copy of the PowerPoint, I will be happy to share the PowerPoint. Not a problem at all. Or I don't know, Menachem, there's a question. Will it be available on YU Torah?
We are going to try to put it up on YU Torah. Usually we put the audio. We're going to try to see if we could put the slideshow as well.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Leah. Good morning from Eretz Yisrael. I wish I was there. Not only because it wouldn't be 11:45 at night, but because I would be in Eretz Yisrael. So.
Thank you, Dr. Novick. We wish everyone a Chag Kasher v'Sameach. I've posted in the chat the next two shiurim. Mrs. Sivan Rahav Meir will be right here in this room starting in about 2 minutes. And Rabbi Penner will be in the other Zoom room, which the link is in the chat. Thank you so much, everyone. And thank you again, Dr. Novick. And everyone have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach.
Chag Kasher v'Sameach, everyone. Enjoy, be well, stay healthy.